my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A Latin American bishop once commented, "When I feed the poor, I'm called a saint. When I ask why are they poor, I'm called a communist." Discussions that address the core issues of democratization of wealth and power are off limits in the corporate and government-controlled media. Movements that have addressed the issue of class power have been ruthlessly repressed or co-opted. Chief among these is the labor movement, which originally had the goal of realizing worker ownership rather than the watered-down present demands of a fair wage. While a good wage is better than a bad wage, workers face an endless uphill battle, and union membership has declined under the onslaught. Tonight we're going to take a look at labor's radical beginnings and how the government has ultimately worked against the interests of working people then and now. During the recent protests at the Democratic and Republican conventions, commercial media, especially electronic media, repeatedly failed to cover the issues that were the subject of the protests. In an article titled "The Media and the Message, Speaking the Unspeakable in Philadelphia and Los Angeles," which was published on August 22nd on the Los Angeles Indie Media website, analysts Sam Simon and Joshua Oppenheimer say that this is because the message of the protests is itself taboo. They wrote, "In the aftermath of the protests in Philadelphia, many protesters and sympathizers were angered by the way the mainstream press almost never mentioned the message of the protesters. We hear an awful lot about violence when one or two protesters break a limousine's windows on the streets of Philadelphia. We hear about the restraint exhibited by the Philadelphia police or the efficiency of the LAPD as they tear gas and pepper spray concertgoers when a handful of protesters attempt to cross a security fence. And we hear of the inconvenience to convention delegates or the patience of the local community. But we hear nothing of the protesters' demands. And just when this conspicuous silence begins to reek of censorship, a, quote, liberal commentator claims to sympathize with America's long traditions of peaceful demonstration and protest and offers a patronizing editorial condemning the demonstrators' lack of focus, message, or clarity. Scatterbrained and visionless, plagued by chronic attention deficit disorder, protesters are criticized for lacking the single-issue pragmatic focus of our parents." Indignant, one writer-activist explained on the Philadelphia Independent Media Center webpage that the police stole our message, that had our puppets and banners not been preemptively seized and destroyed by the police in serious violation of our First Amendment rights, we would have better succeeded in communicating our message. And there is doubtless truth to this complaint, as activists rely heavily on props to get their messages across. A telling example: on July 31st, ACT UP Philadelphia dropped a 75-foot by 30-foot banner over a billboard above one of Philadelphia's central arteries. The banner read, "Bush plus drug company kills. Generic AIDS drugs for Africa now. ACT UP." ACT UP's media-savvy gesture to welcome Republican delegates to Philadelphia forced each photograph to faithfully reproduce the message, placing AIDS in Africa squarely on the agenda, forcing the media either to ignore the issue in its convention coverage or to continue to raise the issue in subsequent debates and editorials. Not surprisingly, The media ignored the issue in subsequent coverage, but this conspicuous silence at least serves to unmask the workings of the media more broadly, suggesting that editors harbor the patronizing hope that either their audience has a very short-term memory indeed, or else demand no follow-up or consistency from their coverage. That said, the plaint that the police stole our message only addresses part of the story. Certainly, the media at least mentions issues raised by the great single-issue marches on Washington, nuclear proliferation, gay and lesbian equality, gun control, or racial equality, to name but a few. These issues fall within the domain of acceptable and thinkable political thought, so long as they remain isolated from more systemic analysis or context. But the protests in Philadelphia and Los Angeles have not focused on single issues. Instead, they've articulated a broader analysis of systemic violence and exploitation that attends a society structured around the lust for individual gain. The protesters' systemic critique of corporate greed and the violence it does to our democracy, the environment, and the people around the world reveals an enemy common to the many single-issue campaigns of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. So it's not surprising that some commentators have criticized the new movement as a mishmash of previously isolated campaigns, gay rights, environmentalism, labor rights, anti-death penalty, etc., joined together with all the consistency and logic of the web link. One article in the Village Voice, The Vision Thing, of July 2000, cited a movement for the kids raised on Ritalin, the Internet generation. But to ignore the logic that binds so many seemingly isolated issues together is to ignore the movement's message, its vision, its indictment of the common violence perpetuated by capital against the environment, the poor, and the people arbitrarily stigmatized in capital's rapacious efforts to divide and conquer its wage slaves. It's not a lack of vision responsible for the movement's eclecticism. On the contrary, it's a visionary critique of capital behind the coalition of previously isolated single-issue campaigns. And so a new movement is born that dares to speak the unspeakable. The media paints the protests as a conflict between brainless kids and calm, intelligent police. CNN's coverage of the first night of police brutality against protesters outside Los Angeles Staples Center refers again and again to protesters without once mentioning why they're protesting. In hindsight, it should not be surprising that the media fails to cover the message behind the protests. The message of the protesters is precisely what's unspeakable in the mainstream press. It has less to do with the confiscation of banners and puppets than the fact that the rejection of corporate domination of politics, the media, and American civil society is too dangerous a message to be broadcast over deregulated airwaves whose sole purpose is to sell audience to advertisers. The media conglomerates have gone to great lengths to establish the parameters for any political debate, and any group that refuses to stay within those guidelines is a serious threat to the media and the power structure that it is their job to solidify. As Noam Chomsky analyzes in Manufacturing Consent, these guidelines haven't been established by a conspiracy, but rather through the interlocking directorships of media conglomerates and transnational corporations, through editorial boards that know their place, through flak-producing think tanks and conservative foundations, through the political attack on public broadcasting, through the reliance on official and easy sources such as police and government spokespersons, through the lack of investment in independent research, and through advertisers who threaten to withdraw their support when the media strays off message. The rejection of corporate domination of politics, media, and civil society, as well as an indictment of the violence that corporations, i.e. advertisers, do both at home and abroad, is certainly off-message enough to make even well-intentioned editors very skittish. For instance, the critique of corporate influence in our political system is an especially dangerous message because it goes for the jugular of American alienation from electoral politics. For many, The response to our elections is apathy and withdrawal. Understandable, given that it matters little who wins. The differences between the parties are minor. The debates are deliberately contorted by media and politicians so that the real issues are nigh impossible to discern, creating a body politic so confused it fails to recognize the corporations footing the bill for both sides of the political process. But should a popular movement take notice, and should the word get out, the transnational corporations controlling most of our media know that it will not take much to move the disillusioned to action against the corrupt political system that passes for democracy in this country. We don't mean to suggest the media is acting in conspiracy, but we do mean to suggest systemic bad faith. Consider the most recent record. 400 protesters were taken prisoner in Philadelphia. They faced impossibly high bails. Some remained in jail for over 2 weeks, simply for participating in nonviolent civil disobedience. The protesters faced torture in the jails and police vans, including pepper spray in the face to discourage jail solidarity. One man was shackled to bars in a crucifix position and was beaten until bloody. Prisoners were hogtied for 14 hours at a time, packed 7 in a cell intended for one. They were denied access to food or water. Some were denied access to toilets and were forced to urinate in their overcrowded cells. Upon release, they were taunted with questions like, "Is it true you peed on each other?" as TV journalists shamelessly tried to spin inhuman jail conditions and major human rights violations into the less-than-human behaviors of protesters' freakish counterculture. We tried hard to get the word out to the mainstream media. We held press conferences where lawyers presented testimony and video evidence of brutality. All the major networks were there, but none reported the story, except as undetailed allegations, even though the journalists had viewed the unedited footage. A hostile reporter for NBC asked, "Why are you telling us this?" As if police brutality and torture in the jails just isn't news anymore. And then, when the protests ended, so too did the shoddy coverage. We heard nothing of the 100 still in jail 2 weeks later, arrested for nothing more than exercising their First Amendment right to free speech. Notwithstanding the few thousand protesters who tried desperately to draw attention to the plight of Philadelphia's political prisoners, without media attention, there is little pressure on government not to violate protesters' First Amendment right to assemble by arresting them needlessly, brutally, and preemptively. And without media attention, there is little pressure on government not to violate citizens' 14th Amendment right to due process by detaining them for undue periods of time or by torturing and brutalizing them in the jails. Pressure may come from the lawsuit certain to emerge over the coming months, but even here, the protesters will have to show damages. The psychological trauma of long, illegal, and brutal incarceration will constitute damages, and surely some protesters detained for an unforeseeably long period lost their jobs, while others were physically harmed by the police. But until recently, the violation of constitutional rights was itself considered grounds for civil damages. The argument was that suspension of our First Amendment rights fostered suspicion of government, a well-founded fear that our constitutional rights are hollow and meaningless. The Supreme Court recognized that this civic insecurity exerts a chilling effect on our ability to take advantage of our constitutionally enshrined freedoms in the future. This liberal ruling was recently overturned by a more conservative court, so protesters will have to prove damages in the conventional way, giving far more latitude to officials who don't respect our Bill of Rights. In the absence of mainstream media attention, and with less legal pressure than before, how can we ensure that our protests make a difference? One answer comes from the independent media centers. Born last November in Seattle, these grassroots collectives of journalists have sprung up around the world to provide progressive coverage of protest and dissent. "If we don't cover it ourselves, no one will," goes the rightfully cynical logic behind the IMCs. If we don't provide the content or analysis, no one will. reaching audiences on Pacifica Radio through Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! And via cable and satellite through broadcasters like Free Speech, Deep Dish, and Paper Tiger TV, producing a daily newspaper, a website, and a follow-up documentary on most major protests, the IMCs are a profound step in the right direction toward democratizing the means of media production and ensuring that the media hears our message. Does this mean that the actions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles have had no positive effect in the mainstream media? Absolutely not. This year's protests have influenced the media without the media even noticing it. All of a sudden, mainstream pundits are forced to defend the United States political and economic system, implying the existence of alternatives, where before they could simply assume that the only real debate in this country was which of the two corporate parties should go to the White House. The actions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles have stretched the threshold of acceptable political thought. The public is coming to realize that the two major parties do not represent the entire spectrum of political possibility. It is becoming mainstream to believe that money controls politics. Another result of the actions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles is that the movement that first showed itself in Seattle is growing and becoming more solid and powerful. We will never have a government that represents real people until there is a movement that raises the political cost of the status quo and forces government to change. The protesters in Philadelphia and Los Angeles are the most vocal elements of a movement that is growing and will continue to grow. For those on the front lines who are discouraged by the poor media coverage, remember that you are changing the way politics is discussed in this country, and you are having more effect than the mainstream press could possibly imagine. And that was The Media and the Message, Speaking the Unspeakable in Philadelphia and Los Angeles, by Sam Simon and Joshua Oppenheimer.
Oh, Mr. Dewey.
Yes?
Dear Mr. Huey.
Huey, not so
Do you think the 80th Congress did their best? There's inflation here today. There's no housing on the way.
No, there isn't.
Is there any remedy that you suggest?
Oh, Mr. Voter, nice Mr. Voter, as my buddy Taft appropriately said, when the price is in excess, people really should eat less.
Then they won't need any houses.
No, they'll all be dead instead.
Oh, Mr. Dewey, dear Mr. Phooey.
Phooey, now that's
all funny. Your statements sound like double talk to me.
Well, they are.
Can you tell me what's in store? Is it peace or is it war? What exactly is your foreign policy?
Oh, Mr. Voter, sweet Mr. Voter, Mr. Marshall's plan is really heaven sent. Peace on earth, goodwill to men, and a mighty strong UN.
Do you promise, Mr. Dewey?
Promise? Oh, I'll promise anything. I want to be the president.
Building Bridges, your community and labor report, brings you a news feature.
You know, Ken, with the Democrats moving to the right of center and the Republicans pandering to diversity, not to mention the involvement of Green Party candidate Ralph Nader and Reform Party candidate Patrick Buchanan, I'm reminded of the election of 1948.
Mimi, wasn't that the year that Thomas Dewey was the Republican candidate and Harry Truman the Democratic Party candidate?
And Henry Wallace ran as the Progressive Party candidate, and Strom Thurmond, oh yes, he was around in those days as well, ran as the candidate for the States' Rights Party. The Republican Dewey was soaring in the polls, and the Democrats were attacking the Republican Congress. And then, to everyone's surprise, Truman won.
Mimi, the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, had a radio show in 1948. On the show, it boasted of the virtues of Harry Truman and attacked the Republican candidate Thomas Dewey. And guess who the program starred? The great communicator himself, a man who in later years changed sides to himself become president, but in 1948 was a liberal Democrat and president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, would you like to hear part of that ILGWU broadcast?
Absolutely.
This is the story of what the Republican 80th Congress and the National Association of Manufacturers have done to bring on inflation and set back the cause of liberal government in the United States. Presented by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, now to Ronald Reagan in Hollywood.
This is Ronald Reagan. You know me as a motion picture actor. But tonight I'm just a citizen, concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, "We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions." But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. Profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946, but what has happened since then? Since the 80th Congress took over, prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through the natural process of free competition. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost a million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises, and this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States. Democratic faces. This is why we must elect President Truman for adequate low-cost housing, for civil rights, for prices people can afford to pay, and for a labor movement freed of the Taft-Hartley law.
Now let's hear historian Eric Fauna put the past in perspective.
What did you think of the speech, and why do you think, why are you going to vote for that man you just heard?
I would certainly support him for any office in the land. This was 1948. He's talking about issues of social class that are no longer part of our political dialogue today. The notion that the conditions of workers are actually worth considering by politicians is something that has completely faded out of our politics. In the 48 election, there were four parties, the Democrats and Republicans, of course, Dewey for the Republicans and Truman running for re-election as a Democrat. You had Henry Wallace on the left as the Progressive Party candidate, who was pushing even more strongly on these economic issues as well as civil rights and opposing the Cold War. And on the right, you had Strom Thurmond from South Carolina and the States' Rights Party, which was formed after the civil rights issue was raised strongly at the Democratic National Convention, and the Democratic Party in 48, for the first time since Reconstruction, made civil rights of blacks a major political issue, prompting a walkout of several southern states and the formation of the States' Rights Party. So Truman and Dewey, each of them was flanked by what appeared at the time to be pretty strong alternative parties. The 48 election was the first post-war election. It also, as Reagan's speech indicates, came after the Republicans had won control of Congress in 1946 and had gone on to pass the Taft-Hartley Act and many other very conservative measures. Many observers thought that the congressional election of 46 was a harbinger of Republican victory in 48. Truman led a very vigorous campaign against the Congress and against the Republicans and really reinvigorated the New Deal coalition by playing on workers' fears that the country might slip back into a depression, that the Republicans were simply draining off income from the working class in order to benefit profits and the well-to-do. Truman succeeded in tying Dewey to the very right-wing Republican Congress and in reinvigorating this New Deal coalition. He also, for the first time, made civil rights a big issue in the campaign, recognizing the growing significance of the black vote in the North. Blacks could not vote in the South at this time, but because of World War II, there had been a significant migration of blacks into the northern and western states where they could vote, and the black vote was becoming very crucial. So Truman ran a very, very intelligent and vigorous campaign. Dewey ran as if he was absolutely assured of election. The Wallace campaign was, of course, a tremendous disappointment to those further on the left who had really hoped that this was the opportunity for a permanent third party to be created. Wallace pushed much more strongly than Truman on civil rights. Indeed, he campaigned in the South for black rights, which took a certain amount of courage at this time, and pulled Truman toward that position in order to maintain his hold on the black vote. But the big issue between Truman and Wallace was foreign policy, and Wallace was strongly opposed to the Cold War, the Truman Doctrine of containment of communism all over the world, and the endless involvement of the United States in suppressing revolutionary movements all over the world. As the election drew near, much of Wallace's support evaporated as many of the more left-wing voters began to fear Dewey's election and felt that a vote for Wallace would be wasted. So it was a very historic election. It maintained the grip of New Deal policies on the presidency. It also secured the dominance in the Democratic Party of what you might call the Cold War liberals, those who were liberal on domestic policy but very powerfully anti-communist and pro-Cold War in international affairs. Soon after the election, the flurry for civil rights was dropped by these liberals. So in terms of race, the 48 election was a harbinger of things to come, but the 50s were not a time when either party really did much on the race issue until the mass movement of blacks really began.
Oh, Mr. Dewey.
You've been listening to selections from a 1948 election year radio program featuring Arnold Stang and Ronald Reagan. Commentary was provided by Professor Eric Fona.
This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special report, filed by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
I represent the working men.
Do you promise, Mr. Dewey?
Promise? Oh, I'll promise anything. I want to be the president.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. Is there aught we hold in common with the greedy parasites?
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Chris Sturr. Next, we will begin a series of readings from Daniel Fussfeld's book, The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor. First published in 1980, this little book traces the history of the labor movement in the U.S., with special attention to the question of how the initial radical anti-capitalist tendencies of the labor movement were defeated to be replaced by the timid trade unionism favored by business interests and the government. A reviewer said the following about the book, quote, "When intellectuals dissect the failure of American socialism, America usually gets the credit and socialism all the blame. We are told that the expanse, economic growth, diversity, and democracy of the U.S. overwhelmed the incomprehensible insular and infighting socialists. The great virtue of this splendid little book is that it reminds us that there was radicalism in working-class America and that it was defeated by means neither democratic nor decent. From the brutality of the Pinkertons and the National Guard to the paternalism of the National Civic Federation, from the judicial murders of the Haymarket Martyrs to the vigilante lynching of Frank Little, this is the story of injunction and imprisonment, of the framing up and the gunning down of dissident workers. No assessment of American radicalism or of American democracy is complete without the kind of information Professor Fussfeld provides." End quote. The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor divides the history of labor resistance in the U.S. between 1877 and 1918 into five acts. We'll read the book, which is 60 pages long, in its entirety over the coming weeks. Today, we will read the book's prologue, which gives an overview of the issues, and the first act, entitled From Mass Strike to Haymarket.
We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the Union makes us strong.
Prologue, The Issues. Some understanding of the extensive suppression of radical labor movements in America is indispensable for an understanding of the economic, political, and cultural history of America. The purpose of this book is to assemble the outstanding facts of this repression for the period 1877 to 1918, when many of the practices, institutions, and ideas of modern industrial America developed. The extent of this repression has been largely overlooked, and historians of labor have tended to explain the absence of a socialist-oriented labor movement by pointing to special economic, social, and political institutions that enabled American workers to cope with their problems without challenging the capitalist system. Their argument can be summarized along the following lines. It is true that there are conflicts between worker and employer in a private enterprise economy, and that prior to World War I, radicalism was significant in American labor. Nevertheless, class conflict was ameliorated by three circumstances peculiar to the American experience. 1. Relatively high wage rates enabled working-class families to avoid the extremes of degradation and exploitation present in Europe. Furthermore, economic growth brought rising standards of living. 2. A growing economy, coupled with a relatively open social order, enabled individuals with ability and intelligence to better their position. Workers were not restricted to a limited class position. 3. When economic problems arose, it was possible for working people to express their discontent at the polls and to use their ballots to improve their condition. Prosperity and high wages, economic opportunity, and democratic political institutions diffused class struggle, in this view, popularized by establishment historians. A second interpretation is associated with the writings of Selig Perlman, who argued that in the United States, workers developed, quote, job consciousness, end quote, rather than class consciousness through experience with what worked and what didn't work. American workers in the 19th century, according to Perlman, were able to form unions during relatively good times when prosperity and high employment levels provided opportunities for higher wages and enabled employers to pay more. But when hard times came, unemployment and labor resistance caused union members to desert their organizations to follow political panaceas, free homesteads, the single tax, greenbackism, and the self-governing workshop. Then, in the latter part of the century, a group of European immigrants schooled in Marxism realized that this political adventurism was antithetical to working-class interests, that workers would have to stick to their union organizations through bad times as well as good. The proper strategy was to build a union that could make gains during good times and play the hedgehog in bad. This could be done, as the leadership discovered in practice, through pure and simple unionism, that stressed immediate gains in wages, working conditions, and job security. In American union experience, as Perlman analyzed it, the emphasis on business unionism was supplemented by control over access to the job through organization based on craft skills, the union shop, and, where possible, the closed shop. Waves of immigration were a continuous threat to workers, and job control through unions could provide some protection. Craft unions, which could offer protection based on skills, were more successful than industrial unions, which could offer only limited protection against new immigrants. In this fashion, job and wage consciousness developed instead of class consciousness, because it appealed to the concrete interests of workers in the special conditions of the American industrial environment. Above all, it worked. Both of these explanations ignore the role of repression in eliminating labor radicalism as a viable alternative for American workers. job consciousness and business unionism, which implied collective bargaining within the existing economic order, were acceptable to an important segment of the business community. Class consciousness and radical unionism, which implied changing the economic order, were not acceptable. Collective bargaining became a national policy enforced by the power of the national state. But if this was the ultimate outcome, the process by which it was achieved was complex. Radicalism in the American labor movement grew and developed from the mass strikes of 1877 to the breaking of the IWW as an effective force in 1918. Prior to 1918, efforts to repress labor radicalism were undertaken chiefly by employers in concert with local and state governments and the courts, with occasional intervention by the national government. This pattern of repression was unsuccessful, for labor radicalism surged back after each major defeat, usually stronger than before. Alongside this class warfare, there appeared a coalition of labor conservatives and corporate liberals in support of a dual policy: collective bargaining to settle labor management disputes within the framework of private enterprise, coupled with legislation to ameliorate the worst conditions of industrial capitalism. This coalition isolated the labor radicals. Then, during the hysteria of World War I, the full power of the national state was used to crush labor radicalism as a viable alternative for workers. The usual interpretation of the history of radicalism in American labor suggests that workers chose business unionism and job consciousness and rejected radical unionism and class consciousness as a matter of free choice in a democratic society. The choice, however, was not free, but was constrained by government action that raised the personal costs of selecting radical unionism and class consciousness to levels that only a tiny minority of working people were willing to pay. The American experience was indeed crucial in channeling workers away from radicalism, but in a manner quite different from that described by orthodox historians. Act 1, From Mass Strike to Haymarket, 1877 to 1887. The mass strike came to industrial America in 1877. The strikes of that summer were spontaneous upheavals of protest and rebellion involving large numbers of dissatisfied workers who were unorganized, without overall leadership, and without a program of action. The closest analogs in recent years were the urban riots of 1965 to 1969. The 1877 riots began among railway workers as a response to wage reductions on the major eastern railroads in the fourth year of a major depression, the worst depression in American history up to that time. Workers on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad walked out in Martinsburg, West Virginia on July 17th and prevented the passage of through trains. The state militia was called out but would not take action against their relatives and friends. Federal troops arrived on July 19th and restored operations of the railroad. This was the first time the U.S. Army had been used to break a strike. The strike spread rapidly to Cumberland, Maryland, however, and the governor ordered in the militia from Baltimore instead of attempting to use the local Cumberland militia. A mob in Baltimore attacked the troops at the railroad station and set fire to the depot. Federal troops arrived the next day to restore order. The greatest violence occurred the next day in Pittsburgh, with a mob of railroad and steel mill workers, unemployed youths, and underworld toughs rioting and destroying railroad property. Across the river at Allegheny City, however, there was no violence. The Trainmen's Union ran that section of the railroad for 4 days, operating passenger and mail trains but stopping the freights. The disturbance spread among railroad workers throughout Pennsylvania, New York, and Ohio, and to Louisville, Chicago, and St. Louis. Anthracite coal miners struck in Scranton, Pennsylvania. In Chicago, the strike spread to many industries. The most interesting development occurred in St. Louis, where a coalition of trade unions organized a general strike and established a workers' government, modeled on the Paris Commune of 1871, that operated the city government for several days. The police and state militia restored power to the elected officials, however, and St. Louis returned to normal. By then, the abortive revolt was over, nationally as well as locally. The events of 1877 were new to the American experience. For the first time, workers had acted as a class on a national scale, even though there was little leadership or organization and no positive program, only protest. Earlier strikes had been called by craft unions, largely on a local basis, and the largest concentrated effort was a widespread strike of local unions in New York City in 1872. But in 1877, unskilled workers led a spontaneous outburst that affected almost all the industrial areas of the nation. And wherever the strike action appeared, quote-unquote order was restored by military force. It was the first great class confrontation in America, and a portent of things to come. The events of 1877 led to a growing polarization of American society. The forces of repression began to mobilize. Many states enacted conspiracy laws directed against labor. State and federal courts revived the concept of malicious conspiracy and applied it to labor organizations. Employers took a stronger stand against union organization using blacklists and strikebreakers. Harassment of union organizers by local police and officials of local governments, often with the cooperation of local courts, became a common occurrence. The state militias, which had almost disappeared after a long period of decline, were revived in 1877 for use primarily as a strike-breaking force. Established by Congress in 1792 as a compulsory national military reserve, the militias had become voluntary organizations and, where the units survived, chiefly social and honorific in function. The militia was hardly used in the Civil War. There was little need for it after 1865 because the regular army was given the task of conquering the Indian tribes of the West, and both state and federal appropriations for the militia dwindled almost to nothing. 1877 changed all that. The militia forces used in the strike had been hastily recruited from volunteers and were almost wholly untrained. They proved almost useless when used in their own localities, apparently because of unwillingness to shoot their neighbors, and elsewhere they required support from the regular army. But by and large, the militia remained loyal to government authority and did not actively move to support the strikers. After the strike, the states most heavily affected began to support the militia more fully. New York State began a long-continued program to build armories for militia units in all large cities. Many states increased appropriations for the militia. Even Iowa began such spending for the first time. All this was done with the support of business and financial interests, whose taxes paid the bills, and with the tacit consent of military leaders who did not want the regular army to be used as a police force. In the years after 1877, the militia, which even then began to be called the National Guard, the name was officially changed in 1933, was used chiefly in breaking strikes. Its voluntary organization was particularly appropriate for that purpose, for anti-union groups could be quickly recruited, mobilized, and armed, and sent to the scene of labor troubles. In some western states, particularly Colorado in 1895 to 1905, strikebreakers, company guards, and troops hired from the Pinkerton Detective Agency were organized into National Guard companies during disputes in mining areas. The strikebreaking function of the National Guard was seldom emphasized by its advocates. Its recruiting was strengthened by establishment of summer camps for its members. Only two states had them before 1877, 32 by 1889, with 25 states paying the troops that attended, and the social club and entertainment atmosphere that grew up in most units, particularly after an armory was provided. Quote-unquote riot training was the chief training provided in most units to about 1910. Increased appropriations for the National Guard from the U.S. Congress seemed to follow spectacular examples of labor unrest. In 1889, following the Haymarket bombing and trial of 1886 to 1887, in 1897 and 1900, after the labor unrest of that decade, And in 1903, after the anthracite miners' strike a year earlier, and simultaneously with adoption by the National Association of Manufacturers of its strong anti-union open shop policies. In each case, however, the role of the National Guard as a national military reserve was emphasized, not its domestic police function. This was a period in which the United States was moving more heavily into international politics, acquiring colonies, developing quote-unquote dollar diplomacy in Latin America, and building a modern navy. In keeping with this change in the nation's international posture, the National Guard was gradually transformed in the 20th century into a more genuine national military reserve. The chief motive underlying the 1903 legislation, which reorganized the National Guard drastically, was the desire to eliminate the deficiencies which had surfaced during the 1898 war with Spain. Nevertheless, the National Guard never lost its domestic police function. Indeed, its role in suppressing mass radical movements was enhanced by the improved training, better equipment, and tightened discipline that marked its development into a military reserve. One product of the 1877 strikes was the development of a domestic police force under the command of state governments that could be used to contain any further outbreaks like those of 1877. On the other side of the class struggle, the events of 1877 brought the Knights of Labor into the open. This organization, which might have become, quote, the fighting organization of a new class, end quote, to use Selig Perlman's descriptive phrase, had been organized in 1869 and became a significant element on the labor scene after the Depression of 1873. Until 1878, it was a secret organization, secrecy being forced on it by employer opposition. After the 1877 upheavals, it dropped its secrecy as it sought to become a mass working-class organization open to all workers, unskilled as well as skilled, in all industries and occupations. Both the leadership and the membership had learned in 1877 that national organization, a program of action, and a strike fund were necessary if economic actions by the working class were to be successful. Strikes were the chief instrument used by the Knights, but without a great deal of success. The organization refrained from calling general strikes of all workers in the belief that general strikes would turn public opinion against the workers and the organization. Rather, the strikes were limited to particular trades, such as an unsuccessful telegrapher's strike against Western Union in 1883, or particular occupations, like a freight handler's strike against the railroad serving New York City in 1882, which was also unsuccessful. The Knights of Labor was not a radical organization in the modern sense. It did not advocate government ownership of productive resources or even big industry, and did not seek to change the system of private ownership. However, its basic thrust was toward workers as a class, and it advocated a more egalitarian distribution of income. The philosophy of the Knights was that workers should get a larger share of the economy's benefits, and that the way to achieve that goal was for all workers to join a single organization that would work actively to better the condition of all workers. In 1880, this philosophy of mass organization on a class basis was considered by many supporters of the existing order to be a dangerous threat. We should view it as the first major step toward a radical working-class philosophy following the unorganized and unfocused riots of 1877. Radical socialist ideologies with a Marxist orientation had already spread to the United States by 1877, but they had little impact on labor unions in particular or working people in general. Nor did unity prevail in the small minority who did bear those ideas. Marxists, LaSallians, anarchists, and syndicalists vied with each other and sought to gain footholds in labor organizations. Success was scanty. Even in Chicago, where a vocal and vigorous group of anarchists gathered, radical ideologies were not strong. It is a mistake to find the origins of American labor radicalism in European radical ideologies. Instead, radicalism in the American labor movement developed slowly and painfully out of the class conflict in the American economy itself. The first step was the rioting of 1877. A second step was the attempt to build a mass organization of all workers in the Knights of Labor. Much of the activity of the Knights centered on unskilled and semi-skilled workers, such as brickmakers, tanners, and freight handlers. It was difficult to work with this segment of the working class. Turnover among workers was high, strikers were easy to replace with strikebreakers, and most workers had little previous experience with organization and strikes. The result was numerous unsuccessful strikes and only a few victories. In addition, the wide diversity of membership in the Knights included many who favored political action rather than strikes around issues like monetary reform, land reform, cooperation, and various socialist and anarchist programs. Another source of weakness was opposition from existing craft unions, which took a dim view of an organization seeking to include all productive workers. Conflict between the two styles of organization became acute in the later 1880s. These rivalries and internal conflicts might have been overcome if the Knights had been able to win some spectacular victories on the strike front to show that the working class could make significant advances through a class-oriented organization. But for the most part, successes were few. The greatest success of the Knights of Labor came in 1885 strikes on the group of railroads controlled by Jay Gould, including the Wabash, the Missouri Pacific, and the Union Pacific. Gould was unpopular in the press and had a bad public image, and was probably the most powerful financial manipulator of the time. The strike was a bitter one, and the initial victory had to be confirmed by a second strike when the companies attempted to renege on the first settlement. But success resulted in a large increase in membership for the Knights, largely of unskilled and semi-skilled workers. This element in the organization had a strongly emotional anti-employer attitude and was quick to support strikes and boycotts. As its membership grew in 1887 and 1888, the Knights of Labor became a militant national organization representing mostly unskilled and semi-skilled workers, many of whom showed a strong hatred for business and capital and were eager to use economic actions against the class enemy. The leadership, however, was more timid. Schooled in the failures before 1885, it was not prepared to use the instrument that the workers themselves presented to the leaders. The rapid growth of the Knights of Labor in 1885 to 1886 was seen as a threat by many of the older craft unions. The Knights, with its stress on working-class solidarity and its organizational pattern of local and regional units, tended to lose sight of the interests of workers in the skilled trades. Indeed, its leadership tended to use the economic strength of the craft unions to promote economic gains for all workers, most of whom were relatively unskilled. Joint economic action by all workers in the interests of all, regardless of skill, was the philosophy of the Knights. Leaders of the craft unions saw this strategy as unfavorable to the skilled workers, as it probably was in the short run. Craft unions were able to limit access to employment opportunities to a much greater extent than unions of unskilled workers, simply because of the relative scarcity of skilled workers and the relative abundance of unskilled workers. Craft unions, therefore, were able to make economic gains not open to unions of unskilled workers, and their leadership felt that this advantage would largely be lost if the policies of the Knights were followed. As a result, the growth of the Knights of Labor after the successful strikes of 1885 was accompanied by a movement in opposition to the Knights among the craft unions. This opposition was enhanced by a drive on the part of the leadership of the Knights to incorporate the craft unions into the Knights. The result was the formation of the American Federation of Labor in 1886 to provide a stronger national organization of craft unions. The very success of the Knights of Labor intensified the split between unskilled and skilled workers and drove a wedge into the working class. Two national organizations now reflected two different philosophies, one job consciousness and the other class consciousness. The Knights of Labor sought to follow up its successes in 1885 with a drive to achieve a standard working day of 8 hours. The movement for an 8-hour day was an old one. It had arisen almost spontaneously out of the climate of opinion in the working class during the long wave of relatively prosperous time from about 1850 to the early 1870s, and had been supported by many craft unions, but had not made much progress. By the mid-1880s, the normal working day was 10 hours, and in some industries, 12 and 14-hour days were common. The 8-hour day was an issue on which both skilled and unskilled workers could unite, for both groups could benefit. It was also a means for spreading work to the unemployed, thereby cutting down on the competition for jobs that tended to drag down wage rates. And it was an economic issue that directly affected workers' incomes and style of life. The Knights of Labor had found an issue around which the entire working class could unite. Employers saw it that way, too, and fought the 8-hour day on class lines as well as on economic and business grounds. The result was the second great confrontation of the emerging class struggle, Haymarket. Haymarket was not an isolated incident. It was part of the continuing drive for shorter hours that, in 1885 and 1886, had been moderately to highly successful throughout the industrializing northeastern states. Reflecting those successes, the Knights of Labor had grown in membership from about 100,000 to over 600,000 in just a single year. But the working class was not united. In Chicago, it had tripartite organization: the Knights, the Conservative Amalgamated Trades and Labor Assembly, composed of some 19 craft unions, and the left-wing Central Labor Union, which was the largest of the three groups. Leaders of several radical political groups were active in the Central Labor Union, and the Chicago anarchist syndicalists actively supported it. Late in 1885, an 8-hour association was organized by the Assembly, the Knights, and several left-wing political groups, and was supported by the Central Labor Union. On the Sunday before May 1, 1886, this organization sponsored a huge rally in support of the 8-hour day, and a general strike followed, starting with 40,000 workers on May 1 and reaching about 75,000 on May 4. The city was in the midst of a class-oriented mass strike like 1877, but nonviolent and well-organized. Trouble began at the McCormick Harvester Works. The company had locked out its union workers in February and hired strikebreakers. On May 3rd, a meeting of strikers was held near the plant, and some of those at the meeting attacked a group of strikebreakers who were leaving work. Police arrived, were met with stones, and fired on the crowd. Four were killed and many wounded. A mass meeting was organized under radical leadership for the next day at Haymarket Square. Some 3,000 people were there, but most left early because of a threatening storm. Only some 200 were left when a squad of about 180 police attacked the crowd. Someone threw a bomb, the first use of dynamite in a civil disorder, killing one policeman and throwing others to the ground. The police opened fire at once, shooting other policemen as well as people in the crowd. The next day, seven leaders of Chicago radical groups were arrested and charged with murder. Another surrendered later to stand trial. The trial that followed was a tragic farce. The jury was handpicked to include people who admitted prejudice against the defendants. The judge was openly biased, and the trial took place in an atmosphere of panic and hysteria. The prosecution argued that the defendants had advocated and incited violence, and were therefore responsible for the bombing and the deaths. All eight defendants were convicted. Seven were sentenced to die, and one to imprisonment for 15 years. The U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the verdict in the fall of 1887. One of the condemned men died of an explosion in his cell, reportedly a suicide. The sentences of two were commuted to life imprisonment. They were pardoned in 1893. And four were executed on November 11, 1887. Thus closed one of the most notorious political trials in American history. No one ever found out who threw the bomb.
We almost missed the damn thing. Chorus is, there is power in a band of working folks, when we stand hand in hand.
That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. I'll teach you the chorus.
There is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
Have you got that again? You understand the chorus? Everybody got it now? All right.
Oh, would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? How would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do you share land to hand? There is power, there is power in a band.
That was the prologue and Act One from The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor by Daniel Fussfeld. In the coming weeks, we will continue reading this history of labor radicalism in the U.S. from 1877 through 1918. The next section of the book is Act Two, entitled Labor and Business Strategies, 1887 to 1902. The songs accompanying this segment have been Solidarity Forever and There is Power in a Union, sung by Utah Phillips.
Union brand. Oh, if you like sluggers to beat in your head, don't organize, all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band working.